This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalist Elaine Shalino first arrived in Iran at one of the most dramatic moments in the country's recent life. She was on the plane with Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979 as he flew from Paris, where he'd been living in exile, to Iran, where he assumed leadership of the revolutionary government. Shalino was a foreign correspondent for Newsweek at the time. After covering the Iranian Revolution, she continued to report from Iran on and off for the next 20 years. In her new book, Persian Mirrors, The Elusive Face of Iran, she writes about the contradictions of daily life in the world's only modern theocracy, a country combining elements of democracy with Islam. She's a senior writer at the Washington Bureau of the New York Times and has also served as the paper's chief diplomatic correspondent, intelligence correspondent, and UN bureau chief. I asked Elaine Shalino about the connection between Iran and the current conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians.
Iran still plays a big role in the Middle East conflict, even though geographically it's very distant. You know, one of the initial goals of Iran's revolution, of Ayatollah Khomeini when he came to power, was the exportation of revolution around the entire Muslim world. This plan failed miserably, except to a certain extent in Lebanon, where Iran still has a playing field. Iran still provides material support and weapons to Hezbollah, and material support and perhaps weapons to the Palestinian rejectionist groups, and is still interested in sabotaging or at least preventing any kind of settlement of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
So do you think that this new conflict opens the door for Iran to become even more active in trying to prevent any further peace process?
Well, it's a tricky question, Terry, because since Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon, the landscape has changed. And even though Iran has turned up the volume rhetorically, there is no evidence, at least in terms of what U.S. intelligence can see, that it has increased its weapon supplies or its material support. So this is very much a policy and a process in flux that American intelligence agencies are watching very carefully to see whether this stepped-up rhetoric is matched by increased support.
How has the rhetoric been stepped up? What are Iran's leaders saying about Israel and the Palestinians?
There have been statements by some Iranian clerics that there should be a holy war and that there should be some kind of real material support. But, we should keep in mind that Iran's spiritual leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, who wields more power than the elected president, has called Yasser Arafat a simpleton and a traitor. You know, there is no love between Iran's Shiite Ayatollahs and the PLO. So this complicates matters because on the one hand, Iran, would like to see, Israel neutralized or weakened. But on the other hand, Arafat is not widely respected. The spiritual leader has said so. And Iran's president, the elected president, Khatami, has said that any settlement that would be acceptable to the Palestinians would be acceptable to Iran.
Why is Arafat looked down on by these Iranian leaders? Is it because he's participating in the peace process, or is it for other reasons?
It's in part because he's participating in the peace process, but Arafat was never regarded as a leading figure of the Islamic world. And right from the beginning, there was suspicion of Arafat, and even though there were always embraces between Ayatollah Khomeini and Arafat, there's never been a close relationship.
Let's talk about the current leadership in Iran before we move on to some of your experiences reporting from the country. The current president, Mohammad Khatami, you describe him as a reformer. In what ways has he been a reformer?
Well, this is a guy who came from nowhere. For 5 years, he was the head of Iran's National Library, and he certainly wasn't a figure on Iran's political scene. He wasn't supposed to win the election in 1997. Another cleric who was the darling of the clerical establishment was supposed to, and Khatami was sort of allowed into the race because, he wore the turban of a cleric and He was one of them. But surprise, surprise, he ran on a platform of tolerance, of creating the rule of law, and creating a civil society for Iran. He appealed to Iran's women. He appealed to Iran's youth. You know, young people make up 65% of the population. 65% of the population is under the age of 25. And he won with an enormous mandate. And the mandate was one of change.
At the same time, though, there's the Ayatollah Khamenei, not to be confused with Ayatollah Khomeini.
I know. They all start with K. It's really quite confusing.
And he's not a reformer at all, from what I've read. So is the Ayatollah at odds with the president?
They have an interesting relationship of cohabitation. They need each other. They're both clerics. They both believe in the Islamic Republic, but they have very different worldviews. But they can't live without each other. Khamenei knows that Khatami, the president, has the mandate of the people, and Khatami knows that Khamenei has the constitution behind him. It's an interesting kind of guerrilla battle that's going on in Iranian politics today.
Are Iranian-U.S. relations warming any, and is the Palestinian-Israeli crisis affecting the possible warming of relations?
Iranian-U.S. relations have warmed very little in the last year or so. The Clinton administration has made a concerted effort to try to change the rhetoric, tone down the rhetoric. Iran technically is no longer an international outlaw. It's no longer a rogue state. It's what they call a state of concern. There has been a minor lifting of some of the peripheral sanctions, economic sanctions on both sides. But Clinton's running out of time, and he can't take any bold gestures between now and the end of his time in office, because the Iranians haven't done themselves any favors. The closure of the newspapers, a ruling by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, that banned parliament, an elected parliament, from considering a controversial press law, was an anti-democratic act. And the trial of the Jews in Shiraz some time ago, together just send a chilling effect on the administration. In terms of the Israeli and Palestinian conflict, the fact that the Iranian foreign minister was in Lebanon, was in Syria, underscoring Iran's support for Hezbollah and the Palestinian rejectionist groups, doesn't help matters. So I'm not very optimistic that we're going to see a change in the short run.
My guest is Elaine Shalino of the New York Times. Her new book, Persian Mirrors, The Elusive Face of Iran, is based on the approximately 20 years she spent reporting from Iran. As you've said, there's a bulge in the population in Iran of people under 25. 65% of the population is under 25. So those people didn't grow up with the revolution. They don't remember the Shah. What do they want that they don't have, the young people in Iran?
Well, you make a very, very critical point, which is these young people, they don't know the Shah. They don't know Ayatollah Khomeini. They don't know the sacrifices of the 8-year war with Iraq. But they do know the internet, and many of them know satellite television. Even though it's illegal, many people have satellite dishes and can watch CNN or the BBC or Monday Night Football. There's even a lively illegal satellite dish producing industry in Iran. It used to be the internet was very, very expensive. Now it's getting much more accessible because you no longer have to make a long-distance call to log on to the internet. So as society changes and as information about the rest of the world becomes more immediate, young people's wants change. You know, young people want to go to university. At the moment, only 1 out of 10 Iranians who apply to university can get in. They want jobs. There is such a huge influx into the labor force every year that Iran needs to create hundreds of thousands of jobs, which it just can't create given its economic problems. They want to be able to get married. They want to have enough money to set up a household. And, you know, they want more freedom. They just want the right to be, in a way, on the streets so that they're not hassled or harassed by morals police who come down on them from time to time.
What's behind this baby boom in Iran, this 65% of the population being under 25?
Well, early in the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini announced that those who made the revolution should breed and should create a generation of warriors for Islam. You know, this was part of the whole battle and whole campaign to export Iranian revolution throughout the entire Islamic world. Well, it backfired, and by about 1987, Iran had one of the largest population rates in the entire world. And so the policy was quickly changed so that it not only became okay to use birth control, but it became preferable to use birth control. And now one can get a free vasectomy in Tehran. There are huge billboards advertising vasectomies. Young people have to go to birth control training classes before they can get married, sort of like what Catholics do with pre-Cana. There are penalties for having too many children.
My guest is Elaine Shalino of the New York Times. Her new book is called Persian Mirrors, The Elusive Face of Iran. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Elaine Shalino of the New York Times. She's the author of the new book, Persian Mirrors, The Elusive Face of Iran. And it's based on her 20 years of traveling to and reporting from Iran. What are some of the rights women don't have in Iran that they seem to want most?
I've got to answer that question first by saying what rights women in Iran do have, because they have a lot of rights that women in other parts of the Muslim world in the Middle East don't have. They work, they vote, they run for office, they run their own businesses, they go to university. They're lawyers, they're prostitutes, they're teachers. But there is a very strict penal code that is anti-women, frankly. A woman's testimony in court is only worth half of a man's. A woman can only inherit half of what a man can. A woman has a very difficult time divorcing her husband if her husband opposes the divorce, unless she can prove in a public court such crimes as impotence or mental illness or drug addiction. The husband always gets custody of the children when the children reach a certain age. And it's interesting, one of the things that war widows did during the war with Iraq is they pushed through Parliament a bill that allowed them to get the children, their children back when their husbands were killed in the war, and the children didn't automatically go to their husbands' families.
Well, getting back to rights women don't have that they seem to want most, what have you learned about that?
Well, women also want the right to wear what they want on the street. It sounds like a trivial thing, but when it's 100 degrees and you've got to wear a scarf on your head and a long robe, whether you're 90 years old or you're 12 years old, it can be a bit oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
Even the most religious women who wear the full black chador that they would hold under their chin to keep it secure want the right to walk on the street without a strange man having the ability to come up to them and tell them that their head covering or their body covering isn't quite enough. It's very simple, basic rights. Women can go to university, so they have won that battle. But yet, whether you're a man or a woman, if you don't pass a morality test as well as an academic test, you don't get in.
You know, there's a photograph in your book of women at a cosmetic shop in Tehran.
Yes.
And they're all wearing, black headdresses and black robes, trying on lipstick. And the person selling it to them is also wearing, a long black robe and a black headdress. And you look at this picture and you wonder, how does the lipstick match?
How does it compute?
Yeah, how does that compute? Where do the women wear the lipstick?
Makeup is basically acceptable now, at least in certain parts of certain cities. Again, it's an episodic kind of experiment, and the streets is one of the battlefields. So you will see women made up like clowns because it's semi forbidden. So you always want to do what's forbidden. But at home, women certainly can wear makeup. I've interviewed the mother of President Hatemi, and she was wearing enormous amounts of eyeliner and a lot of foundation and blush and even a little bit of lipstick. In fact, the president got furious with his mother for talking to me about the question of beauty and just how important it was for Iranian women to look beautiful.
I think a couple of Iranian movies have recently won, in the past couple of years, won big awards at a couple of the film festivals. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about this, what's happening in the Iranian film industry now.
The Iranian film industry is one of the guerrilla battlefields where you've got an explosion of creativity and really where filmmakers are testing the limits of the system. What one sees on the screen is all sorts of ordinary problems of Iranians, their tragedies, their dilemmas. Issues that they might not even talk about in their living rooms are on the screen. Issues like suicide, polygamy, unemployment, the lack of places for young people at university, divorce, spousal abuse, child abuse, murder, all of these, drug addiction, all of these issues are there for everybody to see. And what it is, to a certain extent, is testing the limits. There are films that are screened for just once or maybe for 2 weeks to kind of see whether or not they'll pass the censors. There are films that might be edited for internal consumption but might be shipped out differently for foreign consumption. It's in the interest of the Iranian government to portray Iran as a human country. And I think that all of the attention and acclaim that has been paid to Iranian films has helped improve the image of Iran. This is happening despite the fact that many Iranian films capture the dark side of Iranian society.
Your new book, Persian Mirrors, is based on the 20 years that you've spent reporting from Iran. Not all those 20 years, but you've been back and forth there many times and reported there from there off and on for 20 years. Mm-hmm. Your first trip there, I believe, was when you traveled there with the Ayatollah Khomeini yes. at the time of the Iranian Revolution. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did you get to be on the plane with him?
I'm not an Iran expert. I was never an Iran expert by training. I studied the French Revolution in 18th century France in graduate school, and that's why I was a correspondent in France for Newsweek magazine. And I was the junior person in a bureau with four other people. And so when I volunteered to go out and cover an obscure cleric who had just landed outside of Paris, there were no objections from the senior members of the bureau and Newsweek. And when it came time to put someone on that plane, I went on that plane with more than 100 other journalists. And Khomeini knew it was a dangerous trip. He banned all Iranian women from going on the plane. In fact, the plane carried enough fuel that in case there was any difficulty on the ground, that we could have turned around and gone to Paris. And later I discovered, much later in researching the book, that there actually was a plan by the head of the Iranian Air Force to blow up the plane that was presented to President Carter.
Wow. Did you feel apprehensive on this plane?
I was young and foolish and single. In retrospect, I suppose I could have said I wouldn't have gone on the plane, but it didn't occur to me at the time. Although when we were circling Tehran's international airport for the third time and I could see a sea of the Shah's troops on the tarmac, I did pause for a minute and wonder if this had been a wise thing to do.
What happened when you landed?
Well, there were more than a million people on the streets of Tehran that day, greeting the Ayatollah. And I remember driving into Tehran, there was a sign in four languages that said, "Welcome to the journalists covering the Ayatollah." And we were welcomed with the sweets and kisses because we had helped bring the Ayatollah into the country. The revolution happened, and it was a very dangerous time, a time when all of the weapons that had been in the Shah's arsenals were liberated, quote-unquote liberated, and young people were driving around with weapons much too big for them and that they didn't know how to use on the streets, and using them. There were executions of the Shah's generals, and a revolution was made.
Did you expect that the Ayatollah Khomeini would be as strict a fundamentalist ruler and as dogmatic as he turned out to be, as repressive as he turned out to be?
I think Ayatollah Khomeini duped a lot of people. When he was in Paris, he talked about creating an Islamic democracy, a democratic Islamic republic. As soon as he got back to Tehran, he said, don't use the word democratic. There's no place for it. But not only were foreign journalists duped, Iranian revolutionaries were duped as well. And you see what's playing out now is really the unfinished business of the early revolution. I mean, right now, some of the most diehard reformers were some of the most diehard revolutionaries. And they're saying, hey, you know what? Our revolution got hijacked. We fought to overthrow the Shah to create a democratic society, not one that where a supreme leader, where one man has too much power.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, this has really been fun, and thank you very, very much.
Elaine Cialino is a senior writer at the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. Her new book is called Persian Mirrors, The Elusive Face of Iran. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.